Well, that's appropriately sad music, given the topic we're about to address. I'd like to welcome back to our Little Wireless program one of our erstwhile regulars in PSONAT. He's an award-winning journalist. In fact, over the last 30 years, he's won 35 or more gongs for his reporting, including an award which is often referred to as the Asian Nobel. It's the Ramon Magsaysay Award. And his work, I think, deserves not only awards, but loud applause from all of us. Let me quote the Asian Nobel, what they had to say about him. A passionate commitment as a journalist to restore the rural poor to India's national consciousness. It's with the rural poor that he spends much of his time reporting on the extent of poverty and, as I said earlier, on that catastrophic issue of farmer suicides. So Nat is the rural editor for The Hindu. He's currently in Australia giving a number of lectures, and he joins us now from our Adelaide TARDIS. Welcome back, Sainat.
Good evening, Philip. It's good to hear you after a long time.
20 years of economic reform in India. What's it done for closing the inequality gap?
Well, it's actually widened the gap very considerably, Philip. What you have at the end of 20 years, on the one hand, is the largest number of dollar billionaires we've ever seen, the largest number of dollar millionaires we've ever seen, by the way, which is the fourth highest in the world, are billionaires. On the other hand, you have a collapse of agriculture, massive distress migrations, the worst agrarian crisis we've had in six decades, and a perceptible rise in malnourishment to a point where child malnourishment in India, according to the Government's Planning Commission report, is about double the average of sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm. It's a paradox, isn't it, that 70% of Indians have mobile phones while about the same number have no bank accounts.
That's exactly it. I think the latter is a far more important indicator, that 60 to 70% have no bank accounts, which means that a lot, that tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Indians, their financial transactions are what are politely called informal credit. In other words, money lending and usury. Even in the suicides that you mentioned, debt-driven distress is a central major factor. And we've seen a quarter of a million of them since 1995.
I mentioned that figure at the beginning of the program.
Yeah.
And although, you know, it's metaphoric, I could hear a gasp of disbelief around Australia at that figure. It seems impossible.
Well, actually, the figures are an understatement. The figures are collected by the government's National Crime Records Bureau. Yeah, suicide data in India is classified under crime. So it comes under the Crime Records Bureau. And we have 16 years of data on this. So one way we can find out, is it getting better or is it getting worse? We can divide it into two periods of 8 years each, 95 to 2002, 2003 to 2010. It's actually getting a lot worse. The annual averages of farmer suicides, for instance, in the second 8 years, that is from 2003 to 2010, is far higher, nearly 1,800 per year higher than in the preceding 8 years. So we do know it's getting worse. In the second 8 years, the average is about one every half hour. One every 30, 32 minutes.
So, Nat, are these suicides clustered in any particular part of India or are they spread across the continent?
Yeah, they are clustered very strongly in five states, in particular regions, which have in common the following. One, that these regions are overwhelmingly cash crop, you know, and as against food grain or food crop states and regions. These are cash crop states. Second, overwhelmingly those who have committed suicide are cash crop farmers in debt. And there is a certain geographical contiguity as well. So factors such as water stress and other things come in. But it's also about the whole model of agriculture we've adopted and the policies that we've applied to agriculture. Now, what is most frightening is that apart from these five states where two-thirds of all the farm suicides have occurred, What makes farmers' suicides different from those of, say, students or businessmen or anybody else, is that the other suicides occur against an expanding population base. The farm suicides are occurring within a shrinking farmer base, which means that the ratios are much worse.
I don't want to in any way under. Well, you know, I don't want to diminish the scale of the tragedy, but I'm wondering about suicide in the urban areas. I'm wondering about suicide amongst the unemployed, the desperately poor in the major cities, or even with soul-destroying jobs in factories. We're aware, for example, that there are quite a lot of suicides in one factory in China, which produces a lot of the Apple iPhones and iPads.
That's right. You know, you're quite right, and there have been within specific groups a rise in the number of suicides. In fact, if you take all suicides in India together in the last decade, the suicides went up by 23% decadally. However, the population rose 18% in that time. And that extra 5% is largely driven by massive suicides within farmers. Now, are other sections seeing a rise in suicides? Yes, indeed. You do have distress suicides in urban areas. And in fact, it's been one of the classic deviations in these last two decades. Personally, I mean, I hate saying this, but I think the last great work done on suicides was by Emil Durkheim, too long ago for any one of us to remember which year that was.
Is that right? Yeah.
But at that time, since then, the growing phenomenon was always urban-based suicides. You're quite right about that. But this is a classic deviation in the last decade or two, that more and more farmers are committing suicide, and also people uprooted from the countryside who come into urban situations are also somewhat prone to suicide.
So, Nat, I well recall you saying, and I've read your writings over and over again, in which you characterise market fundamentalism as much a religion as any other.
Oh, absolutely.
And that the mass media, in which you're involved, plays a role in propagating inequalities, in fact, almost seeing them as indispensable to the great dynamic of Indian growth.
That's absolutely correct. The media in India, the dominant sections of the media, have not merely rationalized inequality, they've even celebrated it. I mean, you can be sure that on March 9th and 10th, the newest list of Indian billionaires from ForbesBillionaires.com will be on the front pages of the Indian newspapers and recorded at prime time on Indian television. So they actually celebrate that kind of growth. But I would say that market fundamentalism, you can see it anywhere in the world, it is unraveling. And, well, there's nothing to replace it, but it's unraveling and unraveling very fast. Whether you're looking at Europe just now, where three governments in the last couple of years are basically led by unelected heads of state who are technocrats with a World Bank or an IMF background, including like our own prime minister, unelected and World Bank background. So you have a lot of it coming apart. Even the Arab Spring, which people somehow seem to associate with Google and Twitter, the major issues there were hunger and unemployment. Egypt, Philip, is the world's biggest importer of wheat. Okay. And you have 40%, 60% increases in the price of that. Yes, you do have massive protests around it.
Sure.
So you are seeing this thing unraveling. They don't know how to control it.
But
you
saw in a couple of states in India, things have been raveled a little, haven't they? Because we've got West Bengal and Kerala turning the tide.
In the sense of the farmer suicides, those are the two states that have brought down the farm suicides significantly. I would agree with that. However, those states are also now they're not ruled by the governments that were ruling them at the time you were there. So there's a very different internal political situation in India, which both major political parties, declining in their immediate strength and having to depend more and more on large regional allies. So that's going to be the situation. But you can see the you know, unraveling across the world ever since September 2008 in the U.S., in Wall Street. And but the inequality, that is growing like it has never done before in our history. We now have 55 dollar billionaires and 153 dollar millionaires capable of investing more, who have an investable surplus of more than $1 million.
And that's you've got more billionaires than all the Scandinavian and Nordic countries put together.
Yeah, and a hell of a lot more than Australia.
Yes.
Many more than Japan. I mean, it's amazing how many we have. And those 55 individuals have a wealth equivalent to about one-fifth or one-sixth of gross domestic product. On the other hand, you've got 836 million Indians living on less than 50 Australian cents a day.
Yeah.
And that's a government figure too.
This is LNL on RN, and I'm talking to Indian journalist, an old friend of the program, P. Sainat. Before we move on to attempt to broaden out the issue of inequality, one final question on suicide. What is the cultural or religious attitude to it? You know, that varies enormously from country to country. Is it? I know it's you know, it's in the crime figures. Well, you know, it's still a crime to try and kill yourself in Australia. But what's the religious view on suicide?
It varies from community to community, Philip. Now, Adivasis, tribals, Indians who are tribals, their whole ethos, their whole ethic, their whole spirituality weighs against suicides. And yet, in those five states where the farm suicides are rising, they have begun committing suicide in large numbers. That frightens the hell out of me. Now, there are religious sanctions against suicide, but it isn't stopping people from going ahead. So even though, and then, of course, there are the totally crass attitudes in those sections of people and intellectuals who are not affected. I have heard many, many leading figures telling us, including a leading journalist, that who addressed me at a public meeting once, saying, you know, these guys are basically drunkards. I mean, it's alcohol that's doing it and killing them. Now, the problem with that argument, Phil, is if alcohol is the driving force behind suicide, there would be very few journalists left in the world.
True.
And precious few academics and human rights activists as well.
Yes, and quite a lot of people working in wireless, I think, would also be jumping off buildings. Now, you're talking about the importance of food as an issue in Egypt,
yeah.
And I know Egypt pretty well, and I know the truth of your arguments. But you're also very much concerned that the food riots we saw in 2008 and onwards are not being honestly or reputably reported in the mass media. In other words, there's not an ongoing analysis of the widening economic inequality anywhere, not in the US and not in India.
Correct. That's absolutely right. I mean, if you just look at it, you just look at, say, India. Here we are, an economy that has boasted a growth rate of 8 to 9% for the last decade or so, which shows, in absolute terms, very misleadingly, an increase in food grain production every year. But if we take the 5 years, 2005 to 2009, the amount of grain available per Indian, per capita, is less than it was 50 years ago in 1955 to 59.
You're saying it's worse than before the grain revolution?
Yeah, well, yes, because 55 to 59, the average per capita availability of food grain, 1955 to 59, when India was not even 10 years independent in 55, was 444 grams per day. It is today 436 grams per day for the last 5 years.
We've got a lot of ground to cover. Now, one of the things I always admired about India is that where the newspaper is withering and dying almost everywhere else, newspapers are buoyant in India, and there's a great many pretty good ones. You write for one of the best, but I hadn't realised until I read your stuff how corrupt Indian journalism was becoming. We've had little cash for comment scandals in commercial radio here, but you've uncovered the phenomenon of paid news. Tell us about that.
Yes, the pay-to-print scandal was something we ran very big on the front pages of The Hindu in 2009 during the elections. It's a massive thing. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars here. Essentially, it works like this. You are contesting an election. I'm a major newspaper or television chain. Now, there are restrictions on election expenditures. There are limits on how many $1,000s you can spend in a constituency. Now, you are a very rich person. You want to get around that. You come to my newspaper or to my channel and offer me millions of dollars, and I help you break those expenditure restrictions by carrying all your propaganda, all your election campaigning. I carry it as news while accepting cash under the table. Now, this is not the corruption of individual journalists, which has, you know, marginal and has been around a long time. This is institutionalized corruption of the media. It's the largest media houses, some of the largest in the world, mind you, that have been doing this. So they've been accepting.
It's not entirely unknown in our country.
Oh, not at all. There are very.
And of course, in the US, it's rampant. Oh, yes. But I hadn't realized it was so pernicious in your own country.
Yes, if you remember in the US in George Bush's time, the White House had to cancel contracts with 43 columnists, including Armstrong Williams and Maggie Gallagher, because they were paying them money to promote Bush programs like No Child Left Behind and the anti-abortion ideals of that administration as well. And even before that, you have a very fine television anchor like Barbara Walters. Unfortunately, her television executive sold 8 episodes of her program to Campbell Soup. So all the panelists at some point had to introduce the Campbell Soup slogan into the discussion on whatever happened in those 8
episodes. If I wanted to sort of profit from this exercise, I'd have to say, Campbell Soup.
That's right.
Let me try. Campbell Soup.
The soup motive
Campbell
had to be
soup.
Introduced.
I'm sorry, I've just made a lot of money. Thank you for that. Look, let me change the focus from that outrageous story you've told us to the World Economic Forum, because the summit was held in Mumbai late last year. You were there, unsurprisingly. And let me read from the press release. The decision to host the summit in Mumbai is to reinvigorate the forum's partnership in India and to align its strategy with the evolving global context, as well as the development priorities for India and South Asia. You were there.
That's right.
What did you take from the summit?
Well, actually, I was there because Reuters, possibly by accident, decided to interview me for their television program on the World Economic Forum, which I think is a completely useless and bogus organization, which hasn't got a single one of its predictions right in the last 10 years.
Don't hold back, Sunet. Say what you think.
Yeah, well, you know, they haven't called a single thing right in the last 10 years. But here's a very important thing for you about paid news and corruption in the Indian media. Every year, when the World Economic Forum holds its program at Davos in Switzerland, which is one of the costliest places on earth, there are very often more Indian journalists than there are American. There are more Indian journalists than there are from any one European country. How does that happen? When their own media outlets at home will not spend $500 Australian to get their journalists to cover a drought they want to cover. And yet, spending tens of thousands of dollars to cover Davos. Well, what we uncovered as part of our looking at the whole thing was that a lot of this money was paid without disclosure by the Confederation of Indian Industry. So Indian industry was sponsoring journalists to go there, sponsoring television studio time for our channels, and you will not find in the last several years one critical word about Davos or the World Economic Forum outside of the Hindu.
But you are a constant thorn in the side, a burr beneath the saddle. You're not inhibited. You're not, as far as I know, you're not censored. You're given tons of space.
Well, I'm lucky, and I have been advised not to enter any popularity contest where media owners are the only voters. But Yes, the Hindu has been extremely generous, and we were, you know.
Well, it's not protective of you, isn't it? It's proud of you, and it looks after you.
Very protective. In fact, no other newspaper would have allowed the paid news controversy, where we named all the major newspapers, we named the publications. And by the way, tomorrow in the Supreme Court of India, one of those cases is coming up. The then chief minister of the state I live in, Maharashtra, which you have visited, was the biggest culprit in the paid news business. He stood to be disqualified by the Election Commission because of our stories, and he has gone to the Supreme Court challenging the jurisdiction of the Election Commission to look at his accounts and challenging their jurisdiction to pass any judgment on him. That's coming up tomorrow in the Supreme Court of India and is not being reported in 90% of the media.
I liked when you were covering Mumbai, you noted that in the 48 hours that the creme de la creme of corporate India met in Mumbai to discuss productivity, opportunity and reforms, 94 farmers committed suicide, between 400 and 800 attempted suicide, and nearly 4,000 farmers left farming altogether. And I did skip over a related phenomenon, and that's the ones that don't commit suicide become a part of footloose migration. Can you spend a few minutes telling us about footloose migration?
Philip, the last 15 years, I've been a journalist 31 years and a full-time rural journalist 18 years. I have never seen the kind of distress migrations that I've had to live with in the last 10 years. Even the census, which is not geared, the Indian census is not geared to capture migrations. However, the latest census shows us something so dramatic. Not since 1921, 90 years ago, has it happened that the additional population added to the urban India is larger than the population added between two censuses to rural India. The last time that happened was 1921, Philip, and that was because rural India had lost 11 to 16 million lives to the influenza epidemic. You remember the 1918 to 20, plus World War One.
Yes, and the Indian figures weren't included, I know, in the figures that were published at the time.
Correct. So we didn't have a major influenza epidemic in the 90s or in the 2000s, but yet 91 million people have been added to the urban population, 90 million to the rural population, which argues for me that there have been massive, massive migrations. Second, if you compare the 91 census and the 2001 census, 7.5 million people quit farming forever.
Yeah.
That's at a rate of about 2,000 a day.
So are you still taking those gut-wrenching photographs of yours? Because you are a photographic journalist as well as a master wordsmith.
Yeah. In fact, we have taken that process a little further in that I'm not satisfied at all with what I've been doing in recording that. So I have started something called a People's Archive of Rural India, where we want to record the magic of a countryside that has 400 living languages, more schools of weaving, art and painting than any other five countries can boast of, more languages, more cultural diversity than any other part of the planet.
And many unique occupations. That's one of the
totally
things.
Totally unique occupations, like whether it's in South Asia, you do have some of them, toddy tappers. We have, for instance, a community called the Khalasis, ancient hydraulics experts who have been launching ships from dry docks to the sea since the time of Christ. Okay? Since Kerala, as you know, had a thriving sea trade towards the African countries long, even before Christ. Now, these guys get ships to water from dry docks using traditional methods. In the year 2000, we had a cyclone in Kerala where a train fell off a bridge into the water and the army was not able to get it out because they couldn't get the cranes close enough onto a strong platform. The Khalasis were officially called in by the government. They had that train out of the water in no time. They built little canals, channels, and instead of fighting the water, used the water to move the train to the shore from where the army's cranes could pick it up. So, yeah, we're trying to record these professions. We're trying to put these unique
When you
voices.
Say record, you're talking about video now, aren't you, as well as still photo, still
yes,
photographs?
Yes, video, audio, still photo, and print. And the difference is that this archive, it'll not be me telling the story. It'll be the people telling their stories themselves. So you want a woman agricultural laborer from Orissa will take you through her work, through her skills, through her kitchen, through her family.
How are you funding this?
Ah, that is a very, very good question. The email now circulating amongst my friends, one of whom is a damned accountant, is that I have scheduled my bankruptcy for 2013 March, and that of my friends for 2014.
Does your splendid wife support you with this?
Yes, she does totally. And what we are doing actually, the Magsaysay Award, all those monies become the seed money for this project. We are determined not to take direct corporate funding or direct government funding. We're trying to do it from the public.
You can see why I love this bloke, dear listener, can't you? He's really something. Look, in the minutes we've got left, I want to ask you about the Indian government attempting to fingerprint and iris scan the entire 1.2 billion citizens. What the hell is that about?
It is stupidity on a grand scale. The you know, the UID, as it's called, the Unique Identification Number, whatever you want to call it, this program has not worked anywhere in the world, okay? And I'll tell you why particularly it has to fail in India. You will know that the United Kingdom attempted this program and abandoned it 4 months into the process, the biometric capture and the identification number, due to protests from the public over invasion of privacy. But there are even much larger problems in India apart from a complete disregard for privacy.
We've got to wind it up, I'm afraid.
Yep. Well,
forgive me.
Yep.
But, Sonat, wonderful to talk to you again. And I hope your trip to Australia is productive and that lots of people donate to the great project. Peace, Sonat, rural editor for The Hindu in India, on our next Bruce Shapiro. And we're going to hear about the life and times of filmmaker, Australian filmmaker Tim Burstall, one of my least favourite people, but a fascinating bloke who kept the most extraordinary diary. And we'll be reading bits of it, in all its naughtiness and candour, and I must say vanity, on the programme tomorrow. If you'd like to comment on any of our stories before we have you ID'd and irised and fingerprinted, go to our website abc.net.au/radionational/latenightlive, and you can tweet us on LNL at RN. And please visit In Bed with Philip, our wondrous new website where hundreds and hundreds of the better discussions we've had over the last 20 years are now forever archived. Thanks for listening.